Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Richard Seymour on the politics of austerity in Britain, and then an in-depth look at the fast food strikes, who's behind them, and what they might mean. First, Richard Seymour. Seymour is the author of several books, including The Liberal Defense of Murder on the Contribution of Liberals to Imperial War and The Meaning of David Cameron. His book, Against Austerity, will be out next year from Pluto Press. The other day, a photograph of Cameron, Britain's conservative prime minister, speaking at a fancy banquet clad in dinnerware behind a gold lectern as he called for a regime of permanent austerity, made its way around the internet. Richard Seymour seemed like the perfect guest to clarify the meaning of this latest incarnation of David Cameron. Welcome, Richard. The world was treated to the remarkable spectacle of your prime minister calling for permanent austerity at a posh dinner from a gold lectern. Aside from the visual drama of this, how is this received politically in the British population?
Well, I don't think it's very popular, but it's important to recognize that this is not the first time that Cameron has said this. He did not advertise that this was his agenda prior to the election, of course. And all the parties spoke about it in a very quiet, hushed-toned kind of way. You know, we will have to make some serious decisions. But nobody really talked about the severity of what was coming. Cameron, after the election, said these cuts are going to have to be permanent. We're not going to go back to spending levels of the type that we've had before. You know, it's not popular. People think generally that is going too far. The problem is that quite a lot of ideological underpinnings of austerity are pretty widely accepted, or at least accepted by enough people that they can get away with it.
The government isn't as unpopular as it might be, given the state of the economy and the policies that they pursued.
I would say that there's a good section of the population, not just the rich, but a section of a pretty large chunk of the middle class and the skilled working class that identifies with the Conservatives naturally anyway, and were quite happy to see them go after welfare recipients, for example. It's this punitive ideology that's very prevalent in Britain at the moment. And it was built up under the last government, New Labour, and it was basically the idea that welfare is being absorbed and sucked up by frauds and by scroungers and layabouts. And essentially, it was based on the logic of social resentment. So, you know, given the sort of social stereotypes that spread and the idea that there was an underclass filled with feral children, welfare became associated not with a sort of a citizenship right, but as something that really was being given to the wrong people and as something that you should really have to earn through the correct moral values. And that's what the government is playing on very adeptly, especially with things like workfare.
Now, it's, of course, easy to kick the Tories around, so let's kick Labour around some, too.
Sure.
Now, I was under the impression that public spending did rise during the Labour years. Is that correct?
Yeah, to a limited extent. They initially watched it fall. They kept Tory spending limits, but they did expand it to an extent. It shouldn't be overstated because the rate, or rather the percentage of GDP that went on public spending didn't really rise above the levels of the major administration and certainly didn't rise to the levels that it had been at under the Thatcher administration. So, you know, there is a permanent straitjacket on public spending built into neoliberalism, and Labour pressed at the limits of that because they had to satisfy their base.
Okay, but then you also mentioned an ideological contribution to this punitive atmosphere coming from Labour. Could you develop that some?
Sure. Well, while they were increasing spending on things like hospitals and so on, they didn't want to go too far in the direction of reforming British society, abridging any neoliberal measures that had already been implemented. So instead of that, they resorted to ideologies of social control. So, for example, Tony Blair came up with the idea at one point of saying that the government needed to intervene early on, as early as birth, in the lives of citizens who might go wrong. You know, so they might turn into, you know, young crooks, young tearaways, antisocial people. The same thing with welfare fraud. It was actually New Labour that spent an incredible amount of time and government money advertising against welfare fraud, as if it was a major problem, when we know from statistics that actually it wasn't. So on a whole series of fronts, whether it was crime, even when it was immigration, antisocial behaviour, things that essentially bore on class and the structure of the working class, the government, New Labour government, helped move the agenda to the right.
Oh, and what groups of the population did that appeal to?
This is the difference between New Labour and the Tories. The Tories couldn't reach the working class. New Labour could reach a section of the working class with this ideology because they knew how to speak in the language that ordinary working class people might accept. So they reached a fairly considerable section of what you might call the respectable working class. Obviously, there was a section of the middle class that were already up for those ideas. So they carried along a reasonably large percentage of the population with them.
And then what is the Tories' base?
Well, I would say the Tories' base has shrunk considerably, but they may be in the process of rebuilding it. But insofar as you can pin it down, it consists obviously of the capitalist class. I mean, that is their most explicit supporters. The bedrock, however, electorally, is what's called, the lower middle class, you know, sole businessmen, pub owners, you know, that petty entrepreneurs. And then there's a section of skilled workers, by and large, who have always tended to support the Conservatives. At least 30% of the working class in this country has always voted Conservative.
And then how does the big bourgeoisie break down?
I would say that the dominant sections of the big bourgeoisie, I know this is controversial, but I think the dominant sections are in the banks, in the city, in finance, and, you know, linked to them. There's increasingly highly concentrated manufacturing capital, which doesn't employ much of the workforce, but does produce quite a lot of profit. And, you know, you can see how they're linked to the Conservative Party through various institutions, or rather linked, more importantly, linked to the state. They happen to be the ones who fund the Conservative Party's campaigns, and New Labour spent a lot of time while in office trying to woo them and win them over. And they did for a while, but by the late 2000s, they'd gone back to the Tory fold.
In the US, we have a section of the professional managerial class that's democratic because they're appalled by the social backwardness of the Republican Party. Is there anything analogous in Britain?
Yeah. I mean, the professional middle class in this country has long moved away from the Conservatives. Back in the 50s, the professional middle class would have been overwhelmingly Conservative. As of the 1970s, they started to shift in the direction of either the Liberals or their successors, the Social Democratic Party, and then the Liberal Democrats, or towards Labour. So there's a section of the middle class that are by and large professionals, people who work often in the public sector industries, who are naturally affiliated to one of these centre-left parties.
And let's talk some about the state of the British economy. With here, we're recovering to, in some sense, although it doesn't really feel like that for most of the population. But there are also extremely persistent high levels of unemployment, permanent unemployment. A large number of people have dropped out of the labour force. What are things like in Britain?
Yeah, well, we're talking about a recovery here too, although it has to be said this isn't really based upon a significant increase in investment. There are billions and billions and billions of pounds in terms of money capital being hoarded by companies. They're just not investing because they don't see any profitable opportunities. So what is happening instead is that real estate, investors and stock markets are being allowed to blow a bubble in the housing market centered around London and the southeast. Most of the rest of the country isn't quite affected by that yet, but the overall impact of that has been to produce a slight spurt of growth in the economy. And George Osborne, our Chancellor, has, on the basis of this, claimed success. And my sense is that he's going to be able to go into the next election claiming success and telling his middle class voters and the rest not only that they have recovered the economy, which they won't have done, but that they've stood firm, that they've seen through the policies that they wanted to see through. They've beaten all opposition. Every constituency that could have obstructed them, they've successfully done it. And I think that's how they intend to reconstruct their electoral base, which was vanishing.
I believe the Bank of England is also doing something similar to the Fed here, which is quantitative easing, flooding the system with liquidity, buying up long-term securities, right?
Oh, yeah.
And this is having an effect more in the financial markets than the real sector.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really having much effect in terms of popular consumption, for example, or even in terms of stimulating investment, as I mentioned. But yeah, it is, it's shoring up the banks. It's making them feel a bit more confident. And it is helping the stock markets.
I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, whose book Against Austerity will be published by Pluto next year. Where has the focus of austerity been?
Well, I think this is very interesting because it used to be said, oh, the Tories are coming after everyone at once. They can't get away with that. Actually, they've been much more cunning and careful. First of all, they've gone after traditional Labour constituencies, parts of the welfare state that are to do with education, health, and they started to marketise it. So they've introduced what are called free schools, which are basically privately owned, often business-run, competitive schools. They've introduced, tripling of tuition fees. They have got rid of benefits that would allow kids from working class backgrounds to attend higher education. So they've made that system a lot more elite. Obviously, in part, they are depriving their opposition party of a future base. At the same time, they've also, as I mentioned, targeted a lot of what they've done by way of social resentment. So you've got this new social category, the bedroom scrounger. You know, you've got people who live in houses where if they haven't had a room that could conceivably be considered a bedroom, a spare bedroom, then they're going to see cuts in their housing benefit. They're going to see cuts in their welfare, and it's going to be basically a new kind of tax. There was a story the other day of a family who lived in a house, and they were told by the council that their dining room was in fact a spare bedroom, and that as a result, they would have to pay this tax.
And what has the response of Labour been to all this?
Very weak. The natural tendency of Labour, and this is true of Ed Miliband, every bit as much as it's true of the Blairites, is to tail the Conservatives, to follow them to the right as far as possible, while maintaining some differences. And that's what they tend to have done. And they're overwhelmingly committed to austerity. And they're certainly committed to these moralizing discourses about the poor. When Rachel Reeves took over as, I think it was Shadow Minister for Social Security or Pensions or something, she said that under a Labour government, the unemployed would not be able to just sit there and live on benefits, meaning that she was supporting workfare as a way of getting all the layabouts, in the habit of working.
And this does not alienate the traditional constituency?
It might alienate quite a lot of people. I mean, there are a lot of Labour voters who don't like this talk. But the trouble is that, first of all, there's not really at the moment much of an alternative for them. There are attempts to construct them, but they don't exist at the moment. And second of all, there are still quite a large number of Labour voters who are not welfare recipients and who aren't dependent on transfer payments, who would be quite happy to go along with cuts in that kind of welfare. And you have to understand there's a generational thing here. Over the generations, according to Ipsos Mori, they've tracked the public opinion on the state of welfare, and every generation supports welfare less and less. The youngest generation supports it the least. There's been a crash in the level of support for the welfare state. So just at the same time that popular attitudes are liberalizing and becoming more socially liberal in terms of issues like gay rights, they're becoming more right-wing when it comes to issues like welfare and jobs.
It sounds like when Thatcher said at the beginning of her reign that she wanted not merely to change economic policy but to change people's souls, it sounds like she was rather successful.
I'm glad you used the term souls. I don't think it was Mrs. Thatcher's achievement necessarily. I mean, she did set in place certain economic measures that changed what you might call the balance of calculations for people. So there were, measures such as obstructing union battles, stopping secondary picketing, making collectivist measures harder to undertake to defend your living standards. Instead, though, you could buy your council house. And if you could buy your council house, then you could watch its value inflate as the housing market blew up into a massive bubble. And you could borrow against that. You could sustain your consumption against that. In other words, it reinforced individual strategies of survival. But it was actually New Labour that really worked to communicate these ideas and had far more success in doing so in terms of public spending, in terms of welfare, and in terms of redistribution of wealth. New Labour had much more effect on eroding a fairly consistent social democratic base for redistribution, decent public spending, and a decent welfare state.
But the massification of neoliberal consciousness, where we're all little self-reliant entrepreneurs investing in our own human capital, that's just almost become universally embraced, it seems.
I don't know about universally. I mean, it doesn't have to be universally embraced. I always think it's important to note that, we can take heart in opinion polls sometimes and say, oh, this policy is unpopular. But quite often, it doesn't have to be popular. It just has to be supported by a sufficient minority and a decisive minority, and usually a more powerful minority, and that's sufficient. So I do think that there's quite a large shift in popular opinion, but popular opinion is never simple or unambiguous. It's riddled with tensions, and there are significant sectors of the population who are profoundly opposed to what's happening. The real problem is they're not organized.
Yet, how can the left make any headway in this sort of environment, institutional and ideological?
Well, I think I have some mild hopes. There are some initiatives that I think are possibly going to make a difference. One of them is the People's Assembly. One has heard, and I agree with certain criticisms of the way it organises, but it is basically a good step. What it does is try to organise all the people who are against austerity in a broad social movement. And it brings together churches, unions, So this is a good step forward. Then there is an initiative called Left Unity, which I'm supportive of. It is an attempt to build a political party that is to the left of traditional social democracy. And it's modelled on similar sorts of parties that we've seen across Europe, like Syriza, Die Linke, the Bloco in Portugal. And I think that for those who don't want to just constantly follow Ed Miliband to the right, this is a hopeful development, and we'll have to see where it goes.
And is there anything within the Labour Party itself that's hopeful, or is the Miliband faction totally in control?
Well, there are always hopeful straws in the wind. There's ideologically there's a certain life in the Labour left that it hasn't been before, but organisationally and institutionally, they're very, very weak. I don't think they have a chance of affecting policy at all. And that's why you can get wonderful writers like Owen Jones, who's really one of the best things we have on the British left, and he is in the Labour Party. The trouble is, I think they tolerate him. I don't think they really intend to let him make any difference to Labour Party policy. So I really think we have to find a way to navigate between those sectors of the Labour Party who are willing to stand up and defend the welfare state and fight against austerity, and those who are well beyond the Labour Party by now, because that's actually, I suspect, where the majority of people actually are.
But the sight of a man in dinner dress calling for permanent austerity behind a gold lectern didn't cause people to sharpen up the guillotine blades.
Oh, God, I hope so. I have no idea what the impact of that will be. I suspect when the next opinion poll comes out on this, there'll be pretty overwhelming opposition because, as much as people despise welfare scroungers and immigrants and layabouts and all the other stereotypes, they really, really, really despise the rich.
Well, that's a note of hope to end on. Thanks. That was Richard Seymour, author and keeper of the blog Lenin's Tomb. Google the phrase Lenin's Tomb and you will find lots of really smart and elegant political writing. His book, Against Austerity, will be out next year from Pluto Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Republican visions, symbolic. I can explicit a history of resistance denied by bishops, lawyers, spies, and Grantham hugely petty riding on her crocodile, cross-steaming London Bridge paved with blood and gold.
Ride like lions, shake your chains.
That was some of Robin Hood by the Mekons. Next, Aaron Gupta. Gupta is a journalist, a founder of the New York-based Independent, and co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. He has a piece in these times on just what's behind the fast food strikes that have sprung up over the last couple of years. I really want to be hopeful about them, but I've wondered if there's less behind them than meets the eye. They've received mostly glowing press, something this show has participated in, so Gupta's critical view, the product of extensive travel and interviews, is welcome. Aaron Gupta. First, before we talk about what's going on behind the scenes, let's just lay out this campaign. Lay out what's been going on in the last year or so.
It actually starts in November of 2011 in Chicago, this effort to organize low-wage workers that quickly morphed into a fast food worker organizing campaign. And it began in Chicago and then in New York around the idea of raising wages and unionizing these workers. And as it developed in 2012, two distinct demands emerged. Which is $15 an hour wages and that workers be allowed to unionize free of retaliation. This led to various worker meetings in New York and Chicago and the first one-day walkout in November of 2012 in New York City, where up to a couple hundred workers walked off their jobs, marched through the streets of Manhattan protesting and calling for the $15 an hour wage and the ability to form a union. Over 2013, it spread to other cities, particularly in the Midwest, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Louis, as well as Seattle. And there's been, in 2013, three different series of one-day strikes. Now, that's just kind of what's going on within the campaign. Then there are all the dynamics in terms of who exactly is organizing this, what are the end goals that are being sought, and how the campaign itself is structured, and whose interest really is it in, is kind of the best way to boil it down. Is this really about building a long-term social movement of low-wage workers, or is this more about creating a flashy media spectacle that the union in charge of this effort, the Service Employees International Union, hopes will be able to allow it to win some sort of goals, such as a raising in the minimum wage, such as some union agreements. But to achieve that goal, workers and organizers are saying it appears that SEIU is pursuing a legal and a media strategy rather than an organizing strategy.
Okay, I want to get more into that detail on that, but raising the wage, the fast food, prevailing fast food wage, which is at or very close to the minimum wage, to $15 an hour, would involve moving it from about the 10th percentile of the wage distribution to about the 40th. This is, in other words, a major challenge to the whole structure of the American labor market.
Right.
Did people you talk to involved, do they see it that way? Do they see it they're really, really trying to undertake a major structural reform of the American income distribution, basically?
Well, I think that is certainly a motivating goal. You know, Sam Gidman is one of the people who puts it well, that good-paying industrial jobs just didn't happen. These are something that hundreds of thousands, millions of workers had to fight for and which many died for to get these wages. And because of the shifts in the U.S. economy, the offshoring, the outsourcing, the industrialization, the U.S. doesn't have these type of jobs, plus because wages are being beaten down. What there is tens of millions of these low wage jobs that are contingent, that are part time, that have very few benefits, that essentially pay poverty wages. And if the organized labor movement is going to change the perilous decline it's been in for the last 60 years, it needs to figure out how to organize these sectors and raise these wages. Now, you know, you hit on something that is a real issue, that this causes all sorts of tensions, both inside and outside of the labor movement. As you can imagine, you know, outside of the labor movement, you get people are saying, why the hell should these fast food workers get $15 an hour? I've had organizers tell me this, you know, that they'll hear from people who are like, I went to college and I'm getting paid $15 an hour. But within the labor movement also, particularly SEIU, I have heard from another number of workers who said that they've been at actions where SEIU members are at, and the SEIU members are very supportive, but they'll hear comments like, well, we'd like to get paid $15 an hour. You know, SEIU is a union whose membership, a large percentage, perhaps a majority, are low-wage workers. So there is this big problem across the board, and I think, you know, the unions have finally woken up to the fact that they need to figure out how to deal directly with these low-wage workers instead of putting all their eggs into the basket of industry and the public sector.
Okay, now let's talk something about the organization, this movement. It's, at least to public perception, a bunch of community organizations, different ones in each city. Give us the who's who of who's fronting these things.
So in Chicago, the group that is generally credited with initiating the organizing is called Action Now, which is one of the successors to ACORN. After ACORN imploded in 2009-2010 because of this hit job by the right wing, various chapters in individual cities tried to pick up the pieces, and out of this came Action Now in New York City. In Chicago, in New York City, it's New York Communities for Change, which is allegedly leading the organizing there. Then in other cities, you have organizations like in D.C., it's called Our D.C. Good Jobs Now is present in a number of cities. There's also Fight for a Fair Economy, Change to Win. But for folks who know the intricacies of the American labor movement, they know all these groups are pretty much affiliated with SEIU. Even the ACORN groups worked very closely with SEIU. And so there is very much an attempt by SEIU to cover its tracks. One is, I think it wants to make it appear as broad-based as possible, you know, that it's not just a union doing this. The narrative coming out of the Our Walmart campaign, which UFCW really doesn't try to hide that much, the United Food and Commercial Workers, that it is the one that has really led the impetus to Our Walmart, which stands for Organization United for Respect. I think there is certainly a media perception that here's a union trying to do this desperate action against the discount retailer that has really reshaped the American and global economy, whereas SEIU has been more successful in spinning a narrative that this is a broad-based community effort. Then the other major factor is there's a lot of skepticism in terms of SEIU because of its role in the last 15, 20 years, suppressing rank-and-file movements, signing these deals that basically trade away workers' rights for the ability of SEIU to just get new members on paper for their coziness with the Democratic Party. So there's a lot of suspicion of SEIU among progressives, among the labor movement. And I think in this case, this is kind of a rear guard action by SEIU that, you know, it's fighting the corporations, and certainly to a significant degree, it's fighting the state, but it didn't want to be fighting the left as well, so it's trying to cover its tracks.
I'm speaking with the journalist Arun Gupta, who is a co-founder of Occupy Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the New York City Independent.
And they also are presenting the line that the workers came to us, we didn't come to the workers.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's amusing, you know, that I'm actually getting attacked by some SEIU members who are saying, like, you know, of course it's not spontaneous. And I'm like, well, tell that to your union leaders who are portraying it as spontaneous. Tell that to your PR agency that has received over $1 million, Berlin Rosen, that this is not spontaneous, right? There's no such thing as a spontaneous workers' movement. There's always organizers and organization there in one degree or another. Even in wildcat strikes in the 30s and 70s, there was always organization and leadership there. In a lot of cases, it would make more sense for SEIU just to own this and to be more honest about it. And in terms of the origins of this campaign, I think at least the way many organizers describe it, it got off on a bad foot because of the subterfuge, because they were having the organizers go around and gather names for petitions that they described themselves as phony. So essentially what they were doing in New York and Chicago was the community groups, but which were apparently being paid by SEIU, were having organizers go in fast food restaurants and have people sign petitions saying, like, you know, we want to stop the bus fare hike, or we need more low-income housing. And this was their way just to gather names and contact information. But it actually proved to be really ineffective, a big waste of time, and they weren't being upfront with workers about what they were trying to do, which was that we want to unionize you and raise the minimum wage. And I think if that's, you know, people are excited about the idea that they're going to pay more, why not just, that they could get paid more, why not just tell them that in the first place?
Why not? What's your guess?
Well, you know, in Chicago, where this all began, they were going in with these postcards that did say raise the state minimum wage to like $10 an hour or something like that. And the organizer said that, you know, managers would just immediately throw them out of the fast food restaurant because they were agitating around wages in the restaurant. And so that's when they came up with this idea, like, hey, let's, you know, what's the most innocuous petition we can do? And that's to, like, have a, but where we can suss people out. And that was to have them sign a petition against the Chicago Transit Authority raising bus fares. So, you know, as one worker put it, we essentially fabricated a scenario in which the CTA was going to raise the bus fares. But it wasn't true. There was no proposal on the table. But this allowed them easier access to the restaurants. But it raises a question, why the hell are you trying to organize within the restaurant itself? You know, why don't you actually try finding other points to approach the worker, like outside the restaurant or going into the communities, right? If this is really a community organizing effort, you should be spending the time in the community.
Well, in fact, isn't this one of the selling points of the campaign? It's supposed to be like this community-based organism, not a traditional workplace, but much broader than that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're trying to, like, cobble together all these different, you know, forms, you know, that, oh, this is, like, kind of worker center style where it's, you know, advocacy, that we're using this community campaign. And there are some elements of it. But if a union was serious about trying to organize the fast food industry in the way that SEIU was doing by building a long-term workers' movement, they would have to say to themselves, the leadership would have to say, okay, we're going to go at this for 10 years. But by all indications, especially what I've been told about the strategy, it looks like they're hoping to have something in place by next year. So this is barely a 2-year plan that they're trying. And so it means everything does have to be done very quickly. And this warps the whole campaign because there's one guy who wrote a piece, Eric Foreman in Counterpunch, who he made a very good point that organizers are being pressured to instrumentalize workers, and this distorts the whole relationship between the organizing and the workers. So in other words, organizers are under pressure from higher ups that you need to get this many, they have quotas, you need to get this many workers to sign a petition, you need to get this many workers to sign a union card, you need to get this many workers to come to a meeting, you need to get this many workers to come to a protest, you need to get this many workers to come on strike. And so then the organizers don't see the task as building organizations. You know, I think it's a real question whether you can build shop floor organization, but at least you could try and build more citywide organization. But that doesn't become the goal then. The goal becomes producing the numbers that satisfy the higher-ups.
Instrumentalized sounds like, you know, it's a $10 word for they're using the workers as pawns or cannon fodder in some kind of undisclosed strategy.
I don't want to go further than what I said in the article, but I will say, you know, one organizer did say about a fast food shareholder meeting about how the workers were just shuffled in and shuffled out before the TV cameras. He did say, I don't like how these workers are used like pawns. And there is also, you know, a sense of that the workers are about, it's about producing numbers. People have talked about it's about putting them before the cameras, you know, training them to be spokespeople. There's actually not much training on shop floor organization. And in fact, some workers have described how in their cities, the organizing leadership, which appears to come from SEIU, has not actively encouraged them, and in a couple of instances have discouraged them from doing skill sharing on how to avoid retaliation in the workplace. And so I think that that's something that I think is really problematic. Like, if you're actually not encouraging and maybe even discouraging workers from learning how to build solidarity in the workplace, from learning various tactics on how to workers themselves can take action against the boss if the boss is trying to retaliate, then what type of organization are you trying to build?
I'm speaking with the journalist Arun Gupta, who is a co-founder of Occupy Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the New York City Independent. Well, yeah, there are a couple of things that stand out here. What you just said about the need to build solidarity, to build workplace organizations, but also what I said earlier about really taking on the entire wage structure of the U.S. labor market. This is a lot of rocking the boat, and this is not the kind of thing that SEIU is known for. Are they undergoing a personality change, or is there some strategy that is not visible to the naked eye?
Well, I think the low-wage sector has become a battering ram against unions' last citadels in the heavy industry and the public sector. You know, and a number of people, and I think yourself included, have made this point, is like, look, you know, the reason they can go after the pensions of workers in the public sector is that pensions have virtually vanished in the private sector. And really, since the just full frontal attack began on organized labor under Reagan and PATCO and all that, 30-plus years ago, the union's response pretty much has just been to kind of turn inward, to try and, okay, we're going to organize what's easiest to organize, such as the public sector, or maybe they'll squabble. You'll have some intra-union battles. And so they recognize now that, you know, they need to do something radically different. Is this a personality change? That's a good question. You know, in terms of SEIU, I think it's had a healthy shift since Andy Stern is no longer president. But at the same time, when workers and organizers are describing the campaign to me, and when, you know, they describe the strategy, it's clear it's very much a top-down strategy. and workers feel they have really no say in it. Organizers, the field organizers, feel that they have virtually no say in it. And I've talked to union members who are kind of more managing various chapters of the fast food campaigns, who they actually weren't clear about the strategy either. And I think that's really problematic. Like, when you have your mid-level officials who don't even know what the strategy is, then what are you trying to pull here?
What do you think is the goal? Are they really trying seriously to organize this sector, or are they looking for some kind of political advantage, or what's going on?
Well, there are clearly multiple strategies. I mean, like, I did talk to a veteran labor strategist who pointed out, you know, like, look, whenever you do anything like this, you have, like, essentially all sorts of strategies, like nested strategies going on at once. You know, I think part of this is to burnish SEIU's tarnished reputation, because it has been very tarnished. It's also the cities in which it is choosing to pour its energies. It's doing so because it feels that there is more political potential there, but that this could shore up support and influence with the Democratic Party in those cities, especially if it can get living wage ordinances passed, right? So it's been SEIU was very active in the D.C. living wage ordinance that would have targeted Walmart specifically, that passed the city council in the summer but was overturned by Mayor Gray. And then in Seattle, SEIU was heavily involved in the proposal. I'm not sure where it stands now. It's to raise the minimum wage at the airport, the Seattle-Tacoma airport, to $15 an hour. Then there's also a minimum wage ordinance before the city council in Milwaukee. So that's one strategy. A second strategy is to do more worker center style organizing. And apparently, according to a number of sources, SEIU is putting money into starting up a restaurant opportunity center in Seattle. And it's also working, known as ROC, and it's also working with ROC in other cities. I've been told that it outsourced organizing to them in Houston, where SEIU also has a very active Justice for Janitors campaign going on, but it outsourced fast food organizing to ROC there. So it's, you know, trying this more worker center style strategy. And what distinguishes a worker center style strategy is, because they're not unions, they have to organize around legal issues. But the ones who can, now unions, when they organize, they have, you know, essentially cadres of lawyer to enforce labor law. But worker centers have to rely on the workers themselves to basically be the front line in enforcing labor law. So by their nature, they have to make workers leaders. So it does, it structurally does create a different type of a movement, but it doesn't appear like SEIU is putting a lot of energy into that. Then there is, according to three different sources we talked to, there is a much more detailed strategy. And we put the strategy out there for a couple of reasons. One, it was already kind of out there in various interviews that SEIU officials have given. But two, more important, a lot of workers are skeptical that this strategy is going to work. So this is essentially what it involves. First is SEIU wants to erase the distinction between the corporation and the franchisee. The corporate parent, like McDonald's, has these master franchise agreements where they minutely direct every aspect of the operation, down to how often you have to clean the bathroom, to how many napkins you put out, to everything about menus and uniforms. But in these master franchise agreements are also clauses indemnifying them from any sort of relationship with the employees. So basically, it's a way to outsource the employment and say, like, hey, we have nothing to do with it. Now, in Southern California, warehouse workers who toil in Walmart warehouses have successfully challenged this distinction and have a lawsuit going against Walmart in terms of labor abuses and wage thefts, where a judge found that Walmart is a joint employer. So it appears that that's the first step of the strategy that SEIU is pursuing, that they want to make the corporate parent responsible for the employees of its franchisees. The second step, and we've talked to workers and organizers in pretty much every city, is that SEIU is pouring a lot of resources into documenting wage theft. So the first step is to make the corporate parent responsible. The second step is to say that they're responsible for systematic wage theft. Then the third step is to try to use this information to pressure the corporate parent into signing a neutrality agreement. But there would actually have to be two aspects of that. A neutrality agreement is where the corporate parent says, we're not going to interfere with a unionization campaign. Of course, most things that employers do are illegal, but effectively enforcement has become so minimal that it is de facto legal for corporations to fire workers who are engaged in unionization campaigns, and by some estimates, up to 50,000 workers a year are fired for activities in unionization campaigns. So they want to get a neutrality agreement where the corporate parent agrees that they will not interfere with the campaign, but they would also need to have another agreement where the corporate parent agrees to pick up the increased labor costs of any contract. Now, to be able to bring enough pressure to bear, they hope to mount an international campaign. This is because the biggest fast food companies, they're international corporations. And the U.S. market is saturated, so their growth opportunities only lie in the global market. So SEIU hopes that it can build links to unions in other countries and get those unions to do their own protests and perhaps use pension funds. And so you have this domestic and international strategy that SEIU hopes that they can then go to the fast food giants. And as one person put it, hey, we can make this all go away if you can sign an agreement. And they're, you know, by all evidence, they're it looks like they're hoping that they can do this sometime later next year.
Next year, I mean, this sounds like a fight of enormous scope and scale and time. And like, what they can accomplish in a year.
Yeah, I mean, maybe people are wrong about the time frame, but I think given how quickly everything's moving, it doesn't sound unreasonable that this is what SEIU may be thinking. But I think what the key thing here is, though, is a lot of workers, you know, who didn't know the strategy, but when I was interviewing and saying, like, this is, you know, what I've been told, some of them were aware of parts of the strategy. There was a general sense of, you know, one worker put it, this is a strategy for failure. This is a strategy to sell us out, because they felt SEIU would sign one of these horrendous neutrality agreements that they've become notorious for, where they basically just agree to organize a few shops here and there, but won't touch other shops. The wage increases are minimal, and they end up signing away all these various rights of workers to agitate. But what it does is it gets SEIU more members. Plus, by its nature, it's a legal and PR strategy. It's not about building shop floor organization. And a lot of workers, and I should add, these are workers who already are coming with a politicized perspective, argue it's just like, look, you know, we need to be able to muck up the fast food restaurants at the point of production, right? This is how we're going to win any sort of concessions from them. That's the only way, really, unions have ever won concessions, you know. So this is the reason we put the strategy out there, is because a lot of workers are actually really skeptical that this is going to work. And they're also wary that this is just going to be something that kind of sells them out and gets them very minimal advances, if any, but it gets SEIU new members. You know, SEIU can then, you know, as one worker put it, say, we're the mighty SEIU, look at what we've done. And then they move on to their next campaign.
Okay, so we've been, and perhaps I've been forcing you more in this direction than you wanted to be, but, you know, I'm somewhat skeptical about what this is all about. So let's conclude on a more hopeful note that should this work, it would be of profound and inspiring importance.
I think so, but you know, one worker put it really well. Like, even if it doesn't work, like, look, this has set thousands of workers in motion. It's allowing them to build these relationships. It's given people hope, but most important, they feel like they want workers to come out of this with a positive experience of unions, right? Because you can, this could end up burning many workers who, in the end, saying like, you know, I had a bad experience with this. I don't want to deal with unions again. And this is why a lot of workers are still involved in the campaign, even though they have various apprehensions. They do want it to work. Everyone, you know, we talked to 40 different sources. Well over half of those are organizers, workers, or SEIU members. Everyone wants it to succeed, but the reason that they were willing to talk is because, in their experience, they really are afraid it may not succeed. But at minimum, they at least want people, they want the workers to feel like they had a good experience with unions, so they can take it further the next time that some sort of large-scale organizing effort does happen.
As Arun Gupta, author of a piece on the fast food strikes and In These Times, which you can easily find on the web. Look for his long essay on Walmart, forthcoming in next year's Socialist Register, which should be out in the U.S. next month. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Gang of Four's cheeseburger. Till next week, bye.
Cheeseburger.